This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My final program, this is it. So I'm very pleased to pass this hour with a longtime guest and a very dear friend. Haven Kimmel is a poet and an author based in North Carolina, though she was actually raised in rural Indiana. You may recognize the name from her memoirs, A Girl Named Zippy, as well as She Got Up Off the Couch and Other Heroic Acts from Moorland, Indiana. Haven is also the author of children's books and a creative retelling of the Bible's Book of Revelation. Written lots of books, written lots of poetry, and currently the instructor of creative nonfiction at Duke University Center for Documentary Studies and a longtime friend of this radio show, Haven Kimmel. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. And I'm so honored to fill this role for you today. I'm humbled and moved, but I'm going to miss you so much on the radio.
Well, we can talk more about that. The reason, and I really want you here because you were in on some of those early shows, and I think our conversations together helped form the character of this show. Those conversations that we had were what the State of Things became. It's when people say, I love your show, I always think that this is the kind of conversation they're thinking about in addition to the things that we've laid on top of it.
So interesting? Because we didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know what we were doing.
I didn't either, and I didn't think it was going to work, to be honest. I mean, there were these flights, and we'll launch in a minute, but because I'm going to ask you how you feel about this moment to give us an example of what I'm talking about. But we would launch into deep spiritual conversations, religious, theological conversations. I mean, actual, like the rules of the game in a particular religion, which are out of bounds. You can't talk about that on public radio. People aren't going to accept it. They don't want to hear talking about Jesus. What Jesus was saying on the radio. And we could and did in ways that people would come back and say, I could listen to you and Haven talk forever. I thought, wow, we were talking about, you know, we weren't trying to convert people, very wide-ranging conversation. And I thought, wow, this is powerful. You can actually do this. So there's something about North Carolina, something about the listeners that we had, and then something about the way we were framing those things, as you said, without a lot of premeditation.
No, not at all. I think it might have something to do with the fact that both of us are, I am, and you have been, a Quaker. And Quakers are guided by surprise. It's the spontaneity, the discernment of the moment. Right. I just don't say no to much in terms of, this seems like the right thing to say, so I'm going to say it. And much to the chagrin of others often, but in terms of conversation is an art, and it's also a flow that you either get on or get off. And you and I have been very good at getting on and staying on it.
And being connected. I think the idea of saying what comes to mind or being inspired, that can be very confusing and it can go off the rails if you're saying if I say what I'm thinking and I'm not connected to you and I don't feel an attachment to who I'm speaking with, then it's pretty much narcissism and it's not a very interesting conversation at all. And so it's the openness and the kind of training to have that conversation. I know I've been kind of a religious dabbler and have been impressed with the way the Quaker meetings organize themselves and people honor this notion of waiting for the spirit to move them.
It's very interesting what you said about conversation flow and narcissism. I was asked recently by just an acquaintance how it happened that I was so good at like cocktail parties or dinner parties or just talking to strangers. And it sort of took me by surprise. I don't know. And then I realized and said, well, for instance, someone approaches you. It doesn't matter who on earth it is. It doesn't matter if it's at a dinner party or if it's at Walmart or in a parking lot. It doesn't make any difference at all. And you start to talk and I say to you, where are you from? And you say, I'm from Boston. I say, Boston, what do you love about Boston? Or what is it like to live in Boston? And from that point on, the conversation just moves, because in part, people are not used to anyone really paying attention to them. And they're not used to someone asking the next question. And I don't mean like in the journalistic way. I mean in the heartfelt, the open way of say more about that. and then say more about the next thing. Where's the arrow flying? Mm-hmm. And you follow it and people just light up. They blossom right in front of you. But our culture is adversarial by nature, it seems, in terms of when I'm talking to you, I'm listening in some ways, and in other ways, I'm about to launch. I'm thinking about what I'm going to say or what my response is and how I'm going to appear to you, and not the other thing, which is you can listen and still be completely vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You don't have to speak to be vulnerable. And listening with vulnerability causes anyone you engage with to open up in an entirely new way. And it feels magical to both of you.
That's fascinating that you'd put it that way, because the way it frames it is that often speech is an act of aggression and an act of protection. Right. I'm going to say these words now in order to protect the persona that I am so addicted to, that I want you to know about me, because if you didn't know this about me, I would just die. And if you found out the other thing that I'm trying to conceal with this clever speech, I would just die. So what you're saying is, because this is always fascinating, and I've never understood it, but I think now you've revealed something to me. If you can walk up to that stranger and say, I'm not going to, and it has to be a conscious effort, at least at first, you have to tell yourself, let down the shield. Don't try to be the guy who you know is going to succeed. See what happens. Then you're utterly vulnerable. And at that point, you actually care about them. You actually care about who they are.
Yes.
And now they know that, and they're reading that from you. And they say, wow, there's somebody in front of me who cares about me and isn't trying to, as you say, launch this projected kind of profile of themselves. And they care about who I am. And you're right, they light up.
They do. And I love the way you said it, because our ego structures, many of us, our ego structures are wounded or brittle or, you know, shaky in some way. And so everyone has constructed around those fragilities ways to keep them protected and strong. And one of those is forming identities based on status cues and on particular presentations and modes of speech or whatever. And one of the first things that I discovered caused this to work for me is that I long ago cast aside any sense of I don't care what anyone thinks of me, and I don't care what I look like, and I don't care what so if walking out into the world without wanting to project anything, that means nothing to me. Since I don't want to project anything, I don't need to protect anything.
Right.
And that allows me to look at another and just say, who are you? How are you? What is this life you're living on earth at the same time I'm here?
Yeah, and I'm not afraid of your opinion of me, because you are me.
That's right.
But the one thing I see that a slightly different way, and that the suggestion, I think, in what you just said was something about ego being brittle, maybe you said fragile, but there's something in a sense defective about it. I would say that the ego is operating precisely the way it was designed to operate when it projects that false self to yourself and then the rest of the world. That's exactly what it's meant to do, and to conceal all of your vulnerabilities.
Point.
And so I care deeply about how you feel about me, and I noticed that. And once I started to notice that, and once I started to see how damaging that can be to me and to everybody else, and then recognize that I am everybody else, so I'm hurting me and everyone else at the same time. That's when I started to inspect this little biological tool we have, this thing called ego that the central nervous system has created for our protection. And that investigation brought me to the place, I think, that you seem to have been naturally, where you can actually walk into the crowd and say, I'm ready for you. You can't hurt me. It took me a minute.
Right.
Took me a minute. And it still does. I mean, I still walk in, and the little general, the ego to me is a Cold War general. In the Cold War, you know, we had these generals who, God bless them, they really meant it. They thought we were under attack and we were, all kinds of things were bad things. If we didn't have more missiles and didn't have more tanks, those bad guys are out there and they're going to take us. And every time we thought we were, had turned a corner, they said, no, you know what they're really up to? That's your ego. Your ego's whole job is to build up the defense budget and never let you rest in peace. What do you think?
No, that's a very good point. I've been reading about attachment theory, and one of the experts who I really like refers to what happens in the neurologically, what happens to us in an argument, in a fight, or in a confrontation, is that he refers to the two parts of the brain that are activated first and second as the primitives and the ambassadors. And so the primitives arrive first. And as he says, the primitives have one job, and that is keep you alive. That's it. And kill if necessary. The ambassadors need time to arrive and say, okay, all right, let's calm down. Everything is okay. And that can get skewed with shoddy attachment in early life. And I think that's exactly right, that the ego is, you are exactly right. The ego is doing its one job, and it does require stepping outside the ego, right? But stepping into what is the new function that we assume when we're vulnerable and open with another and fearless? It's what is that part of the human animal?
There is a tease for another segment, if ever I heard one. Talking to Haven Kimmel today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The answer after this. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Haven Kimmel, author, poet. You remember her from her memoirs, growing up in rural Indiana. And after a stint in the seminary, Haven ended up at North Carolina State. She studied with another literary legend, Lee Smith. Currently, by the way, instructor of creative nonfiction at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies, and sitting on three new books. We'll get to that, too. But just before the break, we talked about, okay, so you've got this construct that the central nervous system is responsible for creating this you. And it's a mind-made self. It's a structured self. It's an identity that comes from your reaction to the other world. But then if you set, and it can be dangerous. It can be dangerous. On the other hand, it can protect you, and it's helpful. Look, I have to get up and know what shirt to put on and not to put on my wife's dress because I'm me, not my wife. So the distinction is important. But you asked, when we're starting to become more honest with ourselves and that ego gets put aside, where do we go? What's left? Who is the me that we bring to the world? I'm sure you've thought about that, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are when you ask yourself that question.
Well, I should say, first of all, that as I said to my fiance on our first date, you should know ahead of time, I believe in a lot of things, and I believe I believe with my whole heart. I don't dismiss Buddhism. I don't dismiss things in the East or the West or the Hermetic tradition or the magic. Like, if it makes sense to me and it seems to be efficacious for people, that is so awesome. So I believe in mindfulness and the eternal present and all of that. But I have a name actually for what I do. And I've written a tiny bit about this on Facebook already. But my son, my youngest, Gus, noticed about a year ago and pointed out to me that everywhere I went, so we would go to the grocery store, we would, no matter where it was, I would end up in this really profound conversation with someone really quickly. And often there were tears. People would be crying at the end. And then I would get in the car and come home. And I wasn't even aware of it. And as he said it, and I thought, well, for heaven's sakes, that's actually true. And the week before, it was Valentine's Day, and I was in the scrap exchange thrift store, and there was a long line, and there was a woman behind me who she had fewer things than I did, and I said to her, "Would you like to go ahead of me?" And she said, "No, I'm waiting to talk to the woman behind the counter, who's a friend of mine." And so I, you know, then I turned back around and then I turned back to her and said, are you having a nice Valentine's Day? And she said, I'm not. I'll tell you why. Because all I wanted for Valentine's Day was for my daughter, who's in her 30s, to call me or send me a card or wish me a happy Valentine's Day, like I've always wished it. And she never does. And I don't, it breaks my heart and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, maybe what your daughter wants for Valentine's Day is for you to not ask something of her that she's clearly not able to give. And she blinked and went, I'm changed. I'm changed. And for the next 30 minutes then, she told me her life story. She had been homeless. And by that time, we made our way up to the counter, and the woman behind the counter was a friend of hers. And they, and their lives had, her life had been changed by this pastor in a church in East Durham. And we, as we talked, the woman behind the counter said, but wait a minute, I want to go to a church where you are the pastor. And I laughed and said, oh, that's funny you would say that, because I went to seminary, but I never became a minister. Because, and I thought about it a second and said, because I basically just float around and do this. And the woman I'd been talking to originally raised her hands to the sky and said, laughing, we just built a church. Uh-huh. Right? Mm-hmm. And I said, we built a church. That's what mm-hmm. we did. So mm-hmm. from that yeah. point on, yeah. that's, I think yeah. of it as building a church anywhere I go. There's, you know, the big church, as we know, not the little church, but the big church is invisible. The big church is the truth that is always true and exists eternally and universally. And all we have to do is step into it, like the kingdom of God. It's right before us. And so wherever we are, that's where the church needs to be. And so I don't know how to attach that to the body in terms of where, right. where the church building implement is right. Exists inside of us, but it's definitely not the ego. I do know that.
Well, because here's the thing about the church. I'm going to ask you more about that encounter at the scrap. But here's the thing about and God bless them. Churches and the people and the ministers and the faithful people who go there are all coming from the right heart. But it has to be said that they're literally a wall like that. So what was not between you and the woman at the scrap was a wall or a pew. A constructed thing that adds yet another dimension of separation. And so, right. and again, I am grateful to churches for much of the good work they do. But this kind of thing, I think, you know, we have to talk about this more openly. I want to ask you how you felt, what you feel in that moment. There are two risky things that you did there. One, turn around to a stranger and ask, how is your Valentine's Day? I mean, I'm guessing you don't always ask. That's not like Merry Christmas. You don't just sort of spit it out. Was there something that was going that you felt, some physical somatic experience that you had being that close to her that prompted you to say, you know, Haven, ask her this?
Yes, I suppose so. And I'm not sure, I can't describe what it is, but I pretty much always ask the right first question. Yeah. And I don't know how it happens. It's something about... you know, if we knew more about heaven and earth, Horatio, there probably are all kinds of, there's data floating around everybody all the time, and probably some, we can read it and we don't know it. But for instance, I one conversation began at with a woman at Harris Teeter who was checking me out when I said to her, are you still hungry at night when you work with food all day? Hmm. And she looked up at me with this particular look on her face, which I often get, which is, well, it's interesting you'd ask me that question. And it went from there. So I never really know what it is. I think, I honestly think that this is connected to being a writer. You know, as Henry James said, if you want to be a writer, try to be a person on whom nothing is lost. Hmm. And so I pay very close attention to everything around me all the time. And because it's all, well, this is how, if I were building doing character building, for instance, or world building, this is how a person who lives this exact life at this exact time, this is their car, this is their the way they walk, this is the way they say, this is the way they hold a knife. And so I'm always paying attention to that for verisimilitude, and also because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, all of that data then leads me into this sort of, it's almost, I've described it before as being, and it happens a lot while I'm teaching too. I'll be teaching and the conversation will become very intense and will stay intense for quite a long time. And later I can see the person is a little shaky and I might be a little shaky too, but I didn't plan it. It just happened. And it's a kind of outside temporality vividness. I know that it's happening because things become more vivid and more amplified. Mm. And time seems to slow, you know, everything else disappears and time sort of slows down. And I'm right there in that thing. And all I have to do is stay true to it. And that is where transformation is. That's where revolution is. My beloved archetypal psychiatrist James Hillman said that the problem with therapy, the problem with the therapeutic cell, as he calls it, is that it's about the I, the right. letter I and the I, right. instead of the I of revolution turning out and looking at the world. Right. And so I believe that being available for transformation yourself makes you available right. for transformation for other people.
It's what Jesus meant, I think, when he said, when the eye is perfect, the whole body will be filled with light. It's about seeing, and
exactly.
It's about knowing what to pay attention to. So I'm going to bring you back, because you said, you know, as a writer, you're trained to pay attention. But pay attention to what? Because when I'm at Harris Teeter, I'm paying attention to whether or not that coupon took. Did that 10 cents come on? Could you check that? Did the 10 cents? Because I had the coupon and I'm paying attention, paying close attention, 10 uh-huh. cents. So now you're getting into precisely what I wanted to really talk to you more about, a sense that you have to know what to pay attention to. And it's because your body is now actually focused your whole attention. You said the time slows down, things become more vivid. That's a somatic experience. That's your body telling you what to watch for and forget the coupon. And so when we go back to our original, well, I'll go back to the quote that you had earlier, if only we knew more about heaven and earth, Horatio. When Hamlet and Horatio were having that erudite conversation about what they had just learned in college, ways to rationally figure out how the universe worked, a funny thing happened. They saw a ghost.
Right.
Right? In the midst yes, of their rational yes. discussion. And that's what the ghost, I think, is that thing that's not the ego, that's really us. And that's hard for us to figure out and believe in. It became, you know, the challenge for the entire play, right? Well, was it real right. or was it not? And it is real. That ghost, if you learn to pay attention to that, that energy that is, you know, in the wisdom traditions, they talk about one and they have lots of names for it. Sometimes it's called God, but it's that single thing that is our true identity to which we were all created, connected. Tuning into that and having time slow down and things become more vivid, because when you feel that, you know to pay attention to that and not the coupon. That's the thing to cultivate, it seems to me. And so my question mm-hmm. is, did you cultivate it?
I don't know anymore. I've recently discovered, I found it while moving, I found a notebook of poetry from probably 20 years ago, started 20 years ago, and up to this particular notebook had like up to about 15 years ago, maybe, drafts of things. And one of the poems that I had tinkered with, you know, over and over and over those 5 years, the title was Every Day in the Unseen World. And the first line fed into it. So it was Every Day in the Unseen World, the Radiant Word is Spoken Many Times. And all the rest of it, I could remember exactly what I was trying to describe. And that is my deeply held belief that there is more in the unseen world than in the seen. And it's right beyond our capabilities or right our grasp all the time. And so for me, if the ghost of my father appears and gives me information, A, it would be very dark and very funny and very useless. I wouldn't dismiss it for once. I don't dismiss anything. That's what I meant by I'm open to it all. Right. I was on a panel discussion with Randall Keenan and Danny Wallace and maybe Alan Gerganis and Alan Shapiro and someone else a few years ago. And the question was about the what was going to happen to Southern literature now that no one was religious anymore. You know, now that, right? That's a really good question.
Right. We're down to four pages now in your novel, right?
That's right, exactly. And I said, I am deeply religious. And for me, the goal of that in part, or the reason that it means so much to me as a writer, is because, you know, a dead guy gets up, I'm not going to be the one surprised. It already, you know, happened that one time. Like, I'm not surprised. It's all good for me.
Yeah.
So that sense of, well, here I am, you know, I'm out here floating around in my invisible church and anything can happen. And all of these people are also floating around in their invisible churches, and maybe they know it and maybe they don't. And we make this bit of contact, which is like energy and or electricity. And all I'm trying to do is with genuine compassion and open-heartedness, give them part of my own church and energy. And if they want it, here it is. Mm-hmm. And people always want it. It's so interesting. It makes me think that we are surrounded all the time in ways that makes me so sad to really take it in, by people who are not touched enough and not, no one is giving them the sort of loving attention and care that they need, and they're not giving it to themselves. They're, you know, and not, we're just living our lives. All of us are just living our lives, but there's a kind of poverty, I feel, of spirit all around me. And if I can do anything to assuage that for anybody for one second, I will.
What are the barriers to building that world? It's free. You don't need walls. Anyone who has ever experienced it has felt better than they've ever felt in their entire life, trying to buy things and, you know, find love in all the wrong places. It fails over and over. It's the famous Homer Simpson plugging the frayed, you know, lamp into the socket and over and over again. Uh-huh. Right? And, right? Do you see that? It's right. My favorite image. You know, yeah. it's over and over. And then you come, and that's what all addiction is. And if you look at the rates of addiction in this country, the number of people being treated for anxiety, all of that are indicators of a miserable, impoverished, as you suggest, people in the midst of seeming wealth and technological brilliance. What's the barrier to the truth of the kingdom of happiness, the kingdom of truth, or God, if you prefer, is within you? You got it. It's free. Take it. Use it. Why can't we do that?
Oh, this is one of my favorite subjects, and I absolutely have my answer to it.
Oh, good.
I don't.
Because nobody ever does. That's why I thought I'd put it to you.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Quakers use, in terms of talking about, let's say, the devil or Satan, who does not figure into Quaker conversation much at all. Quakers prefer to use the term adversary, the adversary. And the adversary is from, and stepping outside now of how friends talk about it or Christianity in general talk about that figure. There's a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. Stephen Pressfield is a war historian who has also written this series of books about writing and becoming a writer, and they're very, very good. And The War of Art is written after The Art of War. It's the same sort of style and exactly the same sort of chapters, and follows the same path, but it's about the war that we are in when we try to make art and what we come up against, which is he calls capital R resistance. And resistance, he says, is the force, the power that tries to prevent us from doing anything good, not just art, but justice and anything that we might know would enrich life. Resistance is going to be right there. And if I could turn another direction. So in the tarot, the art of the tarot deck, the devil card, the art on that card is so specific and so careful. What you see is this horrible goat man squatting on a throne. And in his hands, he has a chain in each hand. And those chains are around the neck of a man and a woman. And the woman is naked and has a tail of fire, the symbol for sexuality. And the man is naked with grapes, the symbol of addiction, of wine and addiction. And they're shackled. They have a shackle around their necks. But the shackles are not closed. They could walk right out of them anytime, but they stay. And every time I look at that card or think about it, and any time that someone is telling me about their stuckness in some adversarial underworld situation, the question I ask is, what in where you are right now is so valuable to you that you would keep the shackle around your neck rather than walking out of it?
Haven Kimmel is my guest. We're going to answer that question in the next segment of The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Do stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Haven Kimmel on my last show on The State of Things, and I could not think of anybody who I would rather spend these last moments on the air as host of this program. And just before the break, you're talking about the tarot card and the fact that resistance is something that we always have the opportunity to walk away from, that the chain on the tarot card, that the collar is open, there's a chance to walk away, and somehow we don't. And you ask the question, why don't we? And I know you, Haven, you probably have an answer.
I think I do. Yes, I think so. I think that having encountered people who are very stubbornly wed to, say, crippling anxiety or just generating misery within themselves, it's not that they want to be miserable or anxious or unhappy or bitter. It's that their ability to recognize that this is the adversary at work in you. There is wisdom available. In fact, people have been producing wisdom on this subject since the beginning of the written word. Everyone who has ever thought about this wants to give you this gift of freedom. But the longer that we stay in a state that is a false economy, that is some sort of trap, our ability to understand that we have a choice is eroded and eroded and eroded. With alcoholism, for instance, I don't think it's any accident that we call them spirits. We have a cocktail and the spirit enters us. And that spirit does its, you know, its little frisky dance or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it leaves and we go about our business. With alcoholism, and especially with late stage alcoholism, which I have seen a number of times, the spirits take over gradually and then finally. And there isn't really any person left that can fight anymore. Right. You know, the combination of what it does to the brain and to the body, and the spirits have won. And it's so clear between the metaphorical language and the physical fact that I think it's the same with almost any kind of darkness we drink and won't stop drinking. We eventually the spirit takes over. So at any point, as all Kingdom of God theologies say, the Kingdom of God, just step into it. Just step into the Kingdom of God.
Well, there you go. And that, I think, becomes really the nut of the thing, because you'd still ask yourself the question, what kind of nut would prefer this kind of behavior when they know they could walk out of it and okay, after a couple of times bumping your head, wouldn't you see the light? But I do think this gets to what you just said. Again, in all the wisdom literature, you hear about the power of the now. There is only one time. It is now.
That's
and
right.
All the rest is a construction of this biologically generated thing from the central nervous system called the ego. The ego loves time. The ego hates now, because then defense budget is zeroed out. So
that's
if
correct.
So what happens to me when I've had my trauma and the horrible things have truly happened is I am living in the past. I go over it and over it, what I should have done, what they should have done. I look to the future. Here's what I'm going to do to them. Here's how I'm going to get back. Here's why no one will ever love me again.
And, that's right.
And that whole world is sad, and you can understand it. Absolutely, this is human behavior, but it's this human egoic behavior. And the remedy has always been in the wisdom tradition, let go of that. Live it. What's your problem now? And if you look, it's nothing. The real problem is all of these projections and these ways in which then when I see myself in the future and no one loving me because of the thing I had, that's when I start to get really sad. That's when I start to imagine using some kind of product, using some kind of substance in order to make this pain go away. And the only way the pain goes away is to stop imagining the future and stop imagining a past. The past is gone. There was no past, right? This is the hard thing, it seems to me, right? That's the hard thing.
Well, I don't know why it's so hard. I drive people in my life mad with this. I say to them, to my children, to friends, you understand, right, that in projecting into a future that does not exist, it does not exist. And if there were a way to keep a ledger of all the things you were afraid of that were going to happen, that did not happen, that you were wrong about,
right,
imagine how thick that book would be. You are literally murdering the present
right.
you live in right now. And there's no, what if we didn't do that anymore? And for some reason, that's a thing that comes easily to me, or at least at this point in my life. I will say one of the kids will be very distressed about, well, what if the pandemic, et cetera? Well, what if, and I'll say, where are we right now? We're fine right now. And in fact, we're happy and healthy and wonderful. And so let's be here right now. I think it starts to feel naive to the people around me that I don't recognize why can't you hear me? I'm 19 years old. And clearly terrible things are happening.
Right.
But that's not actually the point at all, because reality is always reality. The poor will always be with us.
Right.
Suffering is an absolute state. There is massive injustice and terror everywhere, but we don't need to borrow it. If we can assuage it, we don't need to borrow it for ourselves to justify making ourselves feel miserable when we're not.
Right, that's it. That really is a form of appropriation, and it's hard
that's
to
right.
it's hard to reckon with, because if you want to do good, and you're saying Haven's telling us to ignore poverty and hunger in the world, it's not what you're saying. That the only way I can handle it is if I am totally present and with the world now, and not projecting myself as a hero, as a savior, projecting myself or projecting others as downtrodden and hopeless, all those things that can cause me misery and spin me into another cycle. They're not going to help the
that's
problem
right.
either. They're going to help me feel like a somebody. But that's the ego. See, that's general ego. The reason you don't let go of that is because general ego, you'll zero out the budget. If I can't convince you that my preparing for that person to do that thing again, or my failure to bring that person to justice, so therefore I must plan now, a devious plan to make sure they get caught. If you can't do that, you're going to get hurt again. And that's general ego's job. And of course, the power of now is to say, I'm not afraid of that. I'm just not afraid.
Right.
There's only one moment in the world, and it is now. And I'm going to take my chances. I think I'll be better off. Frankly, I think the world would be better off.
It has been the most mindfulness meditation has been the single most salvific thing I've ever done for myself as someone who's experienced trauma. The thing about trauma and its effect on the central nervous system is that it can replay itself. It's so tricky that way that trauma replays itself as if it's happening right then. Mm-hmm. So it actually invades the now. It isn't like casting back and reliving
right.
a memory. It's like you're doing it right. It's happening right then.
Right.
I think too, we have to genuinely, and it does sound like some, you know, in terms of your mind, Frank, so you've got some really dark things going on there, buddy. And I wish you the best with the whole planning revenge and et cetera. Because I'm down with that. I do the same.
But there are some people that deserve it. Yeah.
One of the things that living in the moment does, you know, really deeply present living, is that you have to, you forgive. It isn't a matter of forgiving the people around you, the people in your past, or the crimes you feel were committed against you or whatever. It's that they aren't there. And so since they aren't there in the present with you, and you're not dwelling on them, and you're letting the people who were engaged with you in the past live their own moment where they are, that is a kind of forgiveness. It's a kind of letting go of pain and letting go of accusation and the suffering that you experienced then. It's not the same as some sort of Christian, and now I forgive you, as if I have the power to change right. something. But really just a matter of letting people live their own moment as you live your own moment, and no one is causing anyone any pain in that time.
But what would you say to someone who said, "Oh, Haven, you're just repressing that. You're just putting it out of your mind, or you don't want to take the trouble or deal with having to confront that individual, and so it's really what you're describing is just a form of repression."
Yeah, that's all right. I'll take it. I mean, I'm genuinely one of the most cheerful and sunshiny people I know, against all odds. And if that's because I'm repressing things, please God, let me just continue to do that until I die.
But it does sound like that in fact you're not, because you're bringing it to mind and you're examining it and you're saying, what am I really feeling now? It isn't. It doesn't right. exist. Mm-mm. So by calling it up and actually addressing it, there's going to be a feeling. There's going to be a feeling of anger or sadness that's going to go through you and actually kind of physically hurt. Your stomach's going to hurt. Your head might hurt. Something mm-hmm. bad happens when that comes to you. And instead right. of finding the mental way out of it, I'll get them. They'll never do this to me again. Say, you know what? I'm just right. going to look at that. I'm going to stare that thing in the eye. I'm going to feel that awful feeling in my stomach. And, oh, it's gone.
It's gone. I a few years ago, I read a very interesting it was a memoir of a woman, an attorney, who became a heroin addict but stayed functional. Hmm. Very smart and very well written, and it was just written by the alphabet, you know, starting with A. And and one of the first things that she says is, all addiction is nostalgia. Hmm. You are trying to recreate that first time, mm-hmm. and you never ever do. But very gradually, you can't even feel, you can't even remember the first time, right. because now you are on this other train. So that thing about anger or mistreatment or recreating the trauma of our past or some horrible confrontation is that it's nostalgic, right? Because we are nostalgic creatures. So we return again to the scene of the crime because we love to return to things.
Right.
And you know, I feel like if there were a pure intelligence that could arrive on Earth and talk to us clearly, that intelligence would say, what if we didn't do that?
Well, what if that's our intelligence now? I'm going to leave you with this. This is my final question to you, and I want to leave you enough time for it. Where are we headed? Are we, as a species, are we headed to a time when that message might be getting through, or is this extinction or just more misery? Where are we headed?
I don't know. I don't know anything about the future.
Yeah.
I don't know. I used to, when I was in seminary, I loved the Teilhard de Chardin's theory of the omega point of history, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. we were actually evolving toward right. Something really sublime. And I really believed it. And now I feel like I don't really know very much about creation, except, you know, it grinds on and it is, you know, we're tremendously lucky to be here while we're here. And I do see all around me all the time profound steps forward in terms of enlightened thinking and enlightened behavior and trying to cast away the shackle around our neck of ignorance and unkindness and all of that. And then I see, you know, that's not happening at all in other places, and the planet is suffering and animals are becoming extinct. And all I know is how to build a church where I am. I'm not sure at all. I do know that there have been times in this past let's say, 4 or 5 years where I thought, well, you know, I don't think about dying. I don't think about myself dying because I'm not dead right now. But and I never have died, so I don't have any experience with it. But I understand why one might be glad one is going to die because
glad that's over.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I am eternally optimistic, and I believe that because I believe that what is in the unseen world is so much more vast than what is in the seen, that we don't even know what the world is. It's like Mary Oliver says, no one knows what the soul is. None of us know what the world is or what the truth is or what reality is. And at any moment, you know, the dead person can rise right up and lead us home. And I just am trying to stay open to all of it and be ready for whatever light appears.
The readiness is all, which is the punchline in Hamlet.
Look at you. Bring it back to Hamlet. This is why you're the pro, Frank.
And why I'm leaving.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What do you see? What do you think is going to happen? What do you see in the world ahead?
Well, interesting that you mentioned Desjardins, because I do think that there is a kind of an evolution going on. Now, this is a form of narcissism, of course, to think that you are at the epic. You are at the final transition of human history. But and I never would have thought that. But just really in the last year, I have the belief that it is possible for human consciousness to evolve, that we will see enough suffering and enough trauma and enough disruption to see in whole new ways as a species. It's crazy. I've never thought that way. That just seems like supernatural and nuts. I can't shake the feeling that we're going to, you know, wake up one day and say, what were we thinking? and begin to relate to each other in ways that we always should have, and just move forward from there as a species and as a planet, as inhabitants of this planet, and know our place here, and not see ourselves as above it all.
I agree with you completely. I do. And human consciousness is the key. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't make the change there, if we don't begin there, no other system is going to affect it. Right. Nothing external is going to change the road we're on or the fate we have, but consciousness could.
I'm looking forward to it. And Haven, what a pleasure. I knew this was going to go well. Thank you so much.
So lovely to talk to you. Thank you, Frank. And thank you for your years of service.
Been a pleasure. Haven Kimmel, instructor of creative nonfiction at the Center for Documentary Studies, and North Carolina-based writer. And as you heard, much, much more. You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. So this is my last show for real, but we're going to play some replays, some of the shows that have stood out in my mind, some of the more memorable programs. Those old episodes are going to air Tuesdays and Thursdays next month. And on other weekdays in December, you'll get the immense joy of hearing our fresh content. Anita Ra will host the program and going to bring you through some new stuff. I'll take you back into the archives. Been my pleasure, of course, to be part of your community, and hope to see you around. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern, Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wadarski helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.